Welcome to the final tennis-worthy podcast of 2025. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and we're using the turn of the year to look back on a few of the fascinating insights we've brought you over the past 12 months. The International Tennis Hall of Fame celebrates tennis all year round, both via its museum in Newport, Rhode Island, which was opened in a new and modernized version in May, and also through digital media. But the Hall of Fame really comes to life over its enshrinement weekends, the Saturday in the North American summer when new people are inducted into tennis's historical institute. This year, it was a career Grand Slam winner, Maria Sharapova, and the sport's most successful men's doubles pairing, Bob and Mike Bryan. Chris Bowers, as always, looks back at our inductees and picks out a handful of insightful memories in the array of interviews we've brought you throughout the year 2025.
It was one of the most magical moments in the tennis year. Maria Sharapova and Serena Williams had been rivals throughout their playing careers, although the two were never close and occasionally ended up making barbed comments about the other. So it was an act of immense reconciliation when Serena agreed to introduce Maria at the induction ceremony, as well as a massive shock, as Serena's appearance in Newport was a well-kept secret. In the lead-up to the enshrinement weekend, which this year moved from early July to late August, Sharapova told us the story of her early motivation. She was the daughter of itinerant parents and first picked up a racket at the age of four.
I remember my first passion for the sport was about being first in line when I was in a group with five other kids. I wanted to be the first one in line. I wanted to be the one that the coach said, okay, well, this is the drill we're doing. Hey, Maria, can you show the other kids what the drill is? I think it was this idea of leading, of trying something that was unfamiliar, but getting familiar with it and then honing it in and, you know, finding a way to be a master of it. I had a deep passion for the competitiveness of the sport, and I loved seeing improvements. I loved seeing, you know, if something wasn't working for a week, spending a little time with my coach or my trainer and working through the kinks and then seeing results. You know, it's a bit of a return of investment in some ways where you work so hard to try to figure this little puzzle out. And when it all comes together and you see that your effort and the time that you spent focusing on this task comes into life. I think I was inspired by the idea of growth within the sport. I was an only child and still am. And so I was very close to both of my parents, and my father had more of the athletic role where he was so focused on finding the right coaches and the right trainers to make me a better player and just to keep improving day by day, not even month by month. It was, you know, you look at it like you add a few great things and perhaps that will get you a victory or a big trophy. And my mom was, you know, more soft-spoken, and she added an element of education and culture that tennis didn't provide at that time because it was so physical and it was so just focus oriented on this racket and ball. And so being in her presence, I think, opened up my eyes to other things in life, like taking care of yourself and your body. And I was this young girl playing in a very physical and demanding sport. And so she would just, I guess, expose me to other things in life and made sure that I stuck to my homework, that I read the right books, you know, that I found interest outside of the sport. So I think their combination really helped shape who I was as a player, but also as a person.
Bob and Mike Bryan also spoke about their background in the lead up to the induction weekend. Their father, Wayne, was a tennis coach, and their mother, Kathy, had been a doubles quarterfinalist at both Forest Hills and Wimbledon. Tennis was always going to be on the table for any Bryan offspring, and having given birth to identical twins, doubles was really the obvious option. Indeed, Kathy and Wayne had a philosophy for their twins that put doubles ahead of singles. While both boys played singles, it was never allowed to create a situation where one might be better than the other. The twins spoke about their parents' thinking. Bob first.
I think their philosophy is they wanted us to be tight and love each other as brothers and not be competitive in the house. You know, every kid has dreams of being number one in the world, and those dreams can be squashed if you're losing to your brother who's across the room. So we support each other. We were trophy collectors. That was our big thing. We had one big shelves in our room, and we would put our trophies up. We'd play singles and doubles every weekend, trying to collect as many as we could get. And it was Mike and Bob's trophies. It was never, there's Mike's and there's Bob's. So we didn't start playing against each other until we were about 16 or 17 when people started buying tickets to the matches. But I think this helped our relationship. We supported each other on the court. And I don't know, I think that was a very smart play by my parents.
Yeah, we played our first tournament at age six, and we met in the singles final. And we were getting ready to play the match, and our parents were like, okay, you guys aren't going to play. You're just going to flip a coin for it. We flipped the coin. I think I got the bigger trophy. You got the smaller trophy. But then we went out and played the doubles, too. So we brought four trophies home, and we didn't care. You know, we as Bob said, we were trophy collectors. We just had one room, lined them all up, shined them, looked at them every day. And we did that all the way from 6 years old until we were 16. And then tournament directors and people started saying, you guys got to play. And so we started playing, and it was pretty equal once we started. But it did help our relationship. You know, we always kind of support each other. No one was saying, okay, Bob's better or Mike's better. That talk, they're just like, okay, the Bryan brothers. And there were times where maybe one of us was better, but no one cared. And I think it would have demoralized one twin if one started winning.
Some would have said it was crazy, but a record-breaking 119 titles later, the Bryan parents, as well as the Bryan twins, have been well and truly vindicated. The Bryans and Sharapova won their titles in the first two decades of this century, but the big battle for women's tennis was fought at the start of the 1970s. In March, we told the story of the original nine, the first players to be inducted into the Hall of Fame as a group. A lot of tennis fans know the name, the original nine, but how many know what they wanted, what they did, and the background to it? We set out to make the definitive podcast about these nine pioneering women, which involved delving into the Hall of Fame archive to hear from Gladys Heldman, the remarkable woman behind the original nine. She explained how, in August 1970, Billie Jean King, Rosie Casals and Nancy Ritchie asked to have lunch with her. They'd discovered that Jack Kramer, the promoter of the Pacific Southwest Championships, was offering the tournament's male players around 10 times the prize money compared with the female players, and the three wanted to boycott Kramer's event.
I said, well, before boycotting, let me talk to Jack and see if we can get a more equitable distribution of the prize money or if he can get some more money for the women. I talked to Jack about a week later, and Jack took a very negative attitude. He said, if that's the way the women feel about it, I won't give them any prize money at all. And I said, well, Jack, think about it for a couple of days and let's talk again. A couple of days later, he said, no, I'm not going to give them any more money. And I said, well, then I've got a better solution. We don't want to boycott because there are some local women who could play as amateurs and some people who might be going on to Australia or whatever, and they might want to play your tournament. But why don't I do a tournament in Houston for eight top women and I'll have prize money? And he said, well, I could protest, but I won't.
Gladys Heldman. And if you don't know the full story of the original nine, check out our telling of it at tennisfame.com/podcast. Throughout the year, we've themed many of our podcasts on values and attributes that the top players need to excel in tennis. And in October, we focused on mental toughness, which included an interview I did with the four times major singles champion, Jim Courier. The eloquent Floridian credits his mental toughness for being able to stay at the top of the game for a good half dozen years after he felt his biggest rivals had worked him out. But what actually does Courier think mental toughness is?
Mental toughness for me is the ability to handle pressure, quite simply. That's what mental toughness is.
Okay, but it manifests itself in very different ways. Do people have it? Can you develop it?
Yes, to both questions. Some people are innately mentally tough. I think of someone like Rafa Nadal, who I don't know that the work that Uncle Tony did with him to develop him and to make him as tough as he was, the drills, the strategies, maybe some of the mental games that he might have played with him when he was a kid, but Nadal was always just present every point and treated each point individually with disdain for the score. And the people who are not mentally tough, they play against the score as well as their opponent. So there's an ability to compartmentalize that some people naturally probably have, but a lot of it can be learned. And there are lots of mental coaches out there that are really good at giving players strategies and ways to handle those moments, and they're precious moments for tennis players between each point. Those 25 seconds are really valuable, Chris.
So is there a part of mental toughness that is actually almost switching off from certain things like the score?
Well, if you ever talk to a tennis player who's just played a match and played incredibly well and gotten into the zone or the flow state or whatever it wants to be called, you will never hear them talking about how much they were thinking about what they were doing. You'll talk about how much they were just feeling what was happening, and it was very natural. So quieting the mind is very much a part of being mentally tough. In big pressure moments, you want clarity to react and do what's natural and what works best for your tennis game without thinking about the consequences. The consequences are that's the thing that causes people to play in ways that they shouldn't.
Psychological studies that have been done into how players choke and how they get over choking say an awful lot of it is down to just practice, so that you trust what you do anyway. But surely there must be a hurdle to overcome before you can get back to trusting what you do naturally on a practice course.
Well, I love the way you put that. I mean, if you have ownership of your game and you know what you do well and you know what you want to do in certain circumstances, then it's automated to a certain extent. And then you don't have to think about it. And you don't have to wonder, what type of shot should I play? What should my strategy be? You'll just know what it is. What I've seen over the years and felt at times in my career when I was getting nervous was there are two reactions to people who are not mentally tough under pressure. They either try to do too much because they want the point to be over quickly and they don't want to deal with the stress of it, or they want to do too little and they want their opponents to make the mistake and they're not willing to take any risk, even if the opportunity presents itself to play a high percentage shot. So the players who live in the middle and just do what they normally do at the biggest moments tend to do the best in those moments.
Jim Courier talked there about the mental coaches that can help players quieten their mind and develop strategies for those pressurized moments. And he freely admits that he benefited from Jim Lehr, one of the first mental coaches in tennis, when Courier was at Nick Bollettieri's tennis academy in Florida as a junior. In November, Patrick McEnroe spoke to Jim Lehr and asked him which player's experience he'd learned most from.
It actually was a very gradual progression. And every single person I work with, I feel like, is a living laboratory for me to understand a little bit more about how the mind and body work. This is an integrated system. And if you tweak one end of the system, it actually reverberates throughout. So even the look on your face as a competitor, the way in which you look, whether you feel like you're enjoying yourself or this is a horrendous thing that I'm involved in. It's a life and death struggle. The way you walk, the way you carry yourself, what you had for breakfast, what's your blood sugar level, what kind of environment have you been in the school situation, and how much pressure are you feeling in other parts of your life? I began to realize all of this connects to how you're performing at this moment, being able to focus in the moment to moment in a match situation. So we've got to get the person healthier in every dimension. Don't just focus on your tennis exclusively. You have to have great coaches, great physios, great medical attention. And the more we realize it's the whole person that actually makes this possible, that was when I began to realize that is the formula to bring someone. And then if they don't make it to the top, and when I looked at the kids at Bollettieri's, how many of them really were going to go to the highest level of professional tennis and make a living? A very small percentage, but every one of them believed that was their future. And if they didn't make it, it was like all these years were a complete waste of time. What am I doing here? And so for me, it was repurposing all of their lives, that you're in this crucible of tennis to become a stronger, healthier, more character-driven person. And if you get to the top, that's icing on the cake. But you're here to grow up and become a stronger human being for the rest of your life. And the more that message reverberated, every day was an opportunity, not a threat, an opportunity to grow, get stronger in all dimensions, eat a little better, meditate just so that you have a little more peace, understand how to deal with people, how to be more respectful, how to speak the truth and be more authentic. And the more we had coaches who were aligned with those messages, the better they got and the less they actually choked under pressure.
Jim Lehr's holistic approach is designed to make the player the best competitor and person he or she can be. But does being tough mentally mean winning at all costs? At the end of the year, we took a look at sportsmanship in tennis. Indeed, whether there's even room for sportsmanship at the top level, where most line calls are now made by electronic technology. But electronic review can't cover everything, as an incident in the men's doubles final at the 2023 US Open showed. Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury were in a final set against Rohan Bopanna and Matt Ebden when a winning forehand from Ebden brushed his partner's arm on the way through. Nobody saw it, and the umpire called the point in Bopanna and Ebden's favour. But Bopanna admitted the ball had touched his hand, even if very faintly, and said the point should go to Ram and Salisbury. He explained why.
Yeah, it was purely an instinct feeling for me. I knew the ball had touched my arm, and I felt that I needed to be honest with myself, and that's how I've conducted my entire career. That's how I've been raised, to do the right thing, say the right thing, and I didn't think of it it being that much. But obviously after the match, both Rajiv and Joe appreciated that gesture, and Rajiv even mentioned it in his speech. But also later on, a lot of the players, they came up to me and they were really, inspired with, that kind of a gesture, because it doesn't happen, that often. And that's when you really think about it, saying that, yes, there is so much more than just the wins and losses we go through. The way you conduct yourself, it makes a difference. And even when I went back home, there were a lot of parents at my academy who came back and said they wanted to show that incident to their kids, just to, show how much it makes a difference to be the bigger person and do the right thing than, figure out about winning and losing a point, So I think it's very humbling, listening to the, not only your peers, but also, parents of students. And it felt great, but to be honest, at that point of time, it was just an instinct and I just did it, what I felt.
Your partner, Matt Ebden, he was serving. Has he talked to you about how he felt about it? Because obviously it was a tight section of the final set of a Grand Slam final. So there's a lot resting on it.
I think I don't think he had really had a choice really there, because I instantly said it touched my hand. We didn't really discuss and then decide whether I should give it or not. And thankfully, Matt held serve, so was good, and it worked out well. But I think even if it happens again anytime, I think it's me. It doesn't matter whether it was match point up, match point down, or any point of the game, I'm going to, call it upon myself, especially if something like that does happen again.
Rohan Bopanna. And although we didn't know it at the time, Bopanna had just played his final tournament, the likeable Indian announcing his retirement from professional tennis at the age of 45. With 26 tour-level titles and being ranked number one in doubles, Bopanna has had a stellar career. But he'll be remembered for far more than just tennis. There was that act of sportsmanship, but also he gained worldwide respect for his doubles partnership with Isam Qureshi of Pakistan, a pairing that built bridges over a precarious political divide and earned them the Arthur Ashe Humanitarian Award. A true sportsman.
Chris Bowers, looking back over some of the highlights from the Tennis Worthy podcast in 2025. And Rohan Bopanna, what a career he had. Amazing, reaching number one in the world in his 40s as a doubles player. Absolutely incredible. To hear the full range of interviews and features, head to the International Tennis Hall of Fame website or any other podcast platform and search for Tennis Worthy. The year may be over, but there's lots more to come from us in 2026, including interviews and discussions from Australia as the new season gets underway down under. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, president of the Hall of Fame. Thanks to Chris Bowers and our entire team for putting this together. And thank you for listening. Have a happy and successful new year.